You wanna give love to the city, that's a fact. But you're gonna need help if you wanna make an impact.
Well endowed,
you want to be
well endowed
with the Edmonton community.
Things really happen when you find that you're well endowed.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Well Endowed Podcast, brought to you by Edmonton Community Foundation and a proud affiliate member of the Alberta Podcast Network. We bring you community discourse about the amazing organizations and people who come together to make Edmonton strong. I'm Elizabeth Bonkink.
And I'm Andrew Paul. On this episode, we sit down with Darren Jordan and Nigel Williams to chat about Five Artists, One Love, which is celebrating the history of Black music and visual art as part of Black History Month. And we'll check in with our friends at Edmonton Shift Lab for an update on the work they're doing to rethink the way society combats racism. But first, we're going to geek out on Black history with our correspondent, Minister Faust, as he looks at the 26th annual Afro Quiz.
That's right. We're happy to welcome Minister Faust back to the Well Endowed Podcast. You might remember him from episode 10 when he spoke to us about gentrification in the Boyle, Macaulay, and Alberta Avenue communities. This time, he brings us a story about an amazing quiz competition that celebrates African and Caribbean history. Let's take a listen.
So imagine that you went to public school and university and you never learned anything at all about your own culture or people who look like you, except for images that are really pretty much depressing, degrading, or misleading. What would you do in order to change that? Would you maybe produce a quiz show?
Welcome to AfroQuiz 2017. We are really pleased to be celebrating the 25th year of AfroQuiz this year. Can you believe that? 25 years. And these contestants have been studying about history, arts, culture, politics. Students, you must answer in the form of a question. And please address me as Black Alex, if you don't mind.
My name's Minister Faust. And I have always been fascinated by global African peoples. Wherever we have gone, wherever we have created civilization, art, science, technology, architecture, literature, religions, and more, we've been able to shape the world and even shake the world. But if all I had to go on was the education I got in school or university, well, I never would have known any of that. So like a lot of people, I did my own studies. But that's not enough for all those kids out there of every background who didn't receive the initial parental encouragement, mentor guidance, or access to resources that I got. Back in the late 1980s and early 1990s in Edmonton, I belonged to a youth group called Ebony, the Edmonton Black Organization of Nubian Youth. Was founded by a terrific community organizer named Lawrence Fredericks. Well, we got together to discuss histories and cultures and contemporary issues, whether those were showing up in Spike Lee movies or hip-hop albums, and we got to know about ourselves. And it was a very Pan-African group, people of every African background, whether they were South Africans or Jamaicans or Nigerians or Trinidadians or their ancestors came from the United States to settle in Alberta 120 years ago. I was a student teacher while I was volunteering as the education director for Ebony. My co-student teacher did something that I thought was a lot of fun. We were teaching social studies, and she used a Jeopardy format to quiz kids on the material that we were teaching. Kids had a blast. I thought it was great, and right away I decided, hey, we should be doing this in Ebony. This would be 1992-93. At Ebony, it became a big hit, and some of the elders in the community saw what we were doing and asked me and some others to produce something like this at a community level rather than just inside of our youth club. So we handled the portion for high school and university students at the Stanley Milner Public Library downtown in Edmonton, and the elders handled a portion for kids. Well, that was a long time ago, and here we are, 2.5 decades later, and they are still producing AfroQuiz, and it is bigger and better than ever.
This trio from Sherwood Park, Alberta, was on The Ellen Show. Would you watch the clip, please?
I know we better be good to you.
floor. Go ahead. Tanatsua.
Who are the Meleziwe brothers?
That is correct.
Now, I was there at the beginning, but the credit is all theirs for what they've done with it. Producing a big show with online study materials and entertainment and a terrific host named Carlos Andrews, who likes to call himself Black Alex. Kids of every racial background compete because, of course, the best thing is for everybody to know how super, mega, awesome African civilizations and cultures are. So to tell you the story of AfroQuiz back then and AfroQuiz today, let's hear from some of the folks who've lived it.
My name is Darren W. Jordan, and I was a member of the executive for Ebony, and at present I am the producer for Five Artists, One Love, and I'm a child and youth development specialist at the Royal Alexander Hospital.
So when I mentioned to you the other day that AfroQuiz started with Ebony, do you remember what your response was?
I think it was something along the lines of, was that us? Did we? It does seem like it would have been a natural progression for what we were doing and what our goals were back then, which was to connect with Black youth, provide a forum for discussion about Black history and current events as it, I guess, it, how does it pertain to us? But it seems vaguely familiar as a notion, but I've got to be honest, going forward, when I think about AfroQuiz, I think of it as a separate entity put together by some people that were probably very like-minded, but I don't recall actually being part of its genesis.
Yeah, well, certainly the people such as Siani and Saliwa, who took it over, I mean, they have done amazing work with it. It is like, you know, we started off as like a fun activity for Sunday afternoons and as just part of our programming, and they've made it into this massive thing all by themselves.
I figured I'd better go talk to Siani directly to find out what it was that motivated him from way back in the early 1990s, what he saw, what he experienced that made him do so much to make AfroQuiz a success today.
My name is Siani Saliwa. I'm the board chair for the Council for Canadians of African and Caribbean Heritage. The aim of the show is to instill a sense of pride in the kids in our community and for them to be proud of their heritage. At the time it was at the library, I remember people that were very knowledgeable. At the time it was overhead projectors that were used to so we used overhead projectors to get the questions out, and it was very competitive. I just remember just feeling a sort of joy that, you know, I found these people that enjoy their learning and they're learning about Africa, which was fascinating to me. Of course, fast forward today, we have taken over some of the technology from the time that everybody started back in 92. We have now incorporated Jeopardy style template that we use, and that makes it even more cool. And the template uses PowerPoint, but visually it works sort of like the same way that you see on Jeopardy, where you click on it and it will display the answer and then you give the question. We have very, really good MCs. Yourself has come in the last couple of years. We have had another MC who calls himself the Black Alex Trebek.
The Black what?
Alex Trebek. Oh. his name is Carlos Andrews. Really good MC. But yeah, all of that has really enhanced our competition, and it's now a really good competition to come and watch. So I would definitely encourage everybody to come out.
All right. This man has a historic site, Uncle Tom's Cabin, in Dresden, Ontario. Tuma.
Who is Reverend Josiah Hansen?
That is correct.
So I nudged Siani back to explaining how he got involved with AfroQuiz, and along the way he refers to CACH, which is CCACH, or Council of Canadians of African and Caribbean Heritage.
So I first learned about AfroQuiz, I would say back in 1994. I was going to NET at the time, and then I had stopped by the library, and then some of the girls that were involved at Black Students Association at the time.
At the University of Alberta.
At the University of Alberta, they were just looking for people to attend AfroQuiz for whatever reason. And I just happened to be in the area, and they're like, you want to come and join us for AfroQuiz? I'm like, sure. And then I go in, and there's this beautiful contest. I remember one of the things that came out was, all I remember is that this is history that I used to learn back home, and here they are learning about Mansa Musa and Aksum and all of that. And so it was just interesting to me that you'd have a group of people that would be learning about that, things that I learned in school, but they were learning this at their own time and just as something that they did on the side, which was impressive to me. You remember Mr. Lawrence, right? Frederick,
Lawrence, right?
He was part of somehow affiliated with Ebony. I don't know how.
He was the founder, and he also was one of the leaders of the Council of Black Organizations, exactly. Which is the predecessor to CASH.
Right, which is the predecessor to CASH. So what ended up happening is that Ebony somehow, after you left, he went down the drain, and then, well, that's a tough word to use, but what eventually ended up happening is he wanted to revive that. And so because I was a part of CASH at that time, Mr. Frederick saw my potential and he was like, I think you should be a leader for something like that, which is what we did with Ebony.
Ahelia, were we with you? Go ahead, please.
Canadiana for 500.
Canadiana for 500, please.
It takes a huge number of people to make AfroQuiz work. Education professor Dr. Jenny Kelly was a driving force for many years. And absolutely, from the very beginning, perhaps the most important person to make it work at a community level was Jeanette Austin Odina. An annual fundraiser for AfroQuiz is named in honor of her late son, Imhotep Austin. One of the amazing things about AfroQuiz is how young people who began as competitors go on to do extraordinary things and in some cases become key organizers of AfroQuiz itself. This is Melody Caesar, and she's a woman who practically runs the whole show. In fact, professional event planning is now part of her portfolio.
Well, one of the coolest things I learned growing up was learning about the contributions and the history of Black people in Alberta. So I was growing up in Edmonton and in Canada, but I didn't really know that until I joined AfroQuiz. So I think that's really important for kids and people living in this city and in this province.
So that's Melody Caesar, all grown up and now organizing AfroQuiz. What about young people who are competing right now, as well as parents and other community members who were involved? How do they feel about AfroQuiz?
I feel very excited. It's my first year, and well, I really want to learn more about my African history, and like, it's really important to me.
My name is Bari Soa. This is my third year contesting on AfroQuiz, and every year I wait impatiently for a new topic. On my first year, I came in second place. On my second year, I came in first place. This is my third year now, and I'm taking first place.
I like it because it helps me memorize. It helps me with my schoolwork too, and knowing how to memorize like specific information, it kind of just trains my brain, and it's fun.
My name is Chaitanya, and I am 10 years old. I think I did really well. I answered lots of questions, and I want to come here again. It's really fun.
My name is Bert Richard. I'm volunteering with AfroQuiz this year. And as a parent, I value AfroQuiz because it allows me to help develop my kids' study abilities. And it helps us get closer as a family as a result. And there are very few events that go on for Caribbean or African Canadians that bring families together like this. And that's why I value AfroQuiz.
When I was studying, it was just cool to realize that you don't have to fit inside of a stereotype, but you could actually grow, think outside the box, and dream and do great things in this world.
I'm extremely happy. I think my daughter knows more about African history, say, in the last 3 or 4 weeks, which she has been preparing for this quiz, than probably the previous 9 years of her life. So I intend to continue this, and she's super excited.
I asked Siani and Darren to tell me why it's important to receive the kind of knowledge that AfroQuiz provides.
Like, for instance, Mansa Musa is the richest person that ever walked the face of the earth. Nobody gets to know about that. And yet, we knew about that back in Malawi, like I said. And so that is not so much emphasized. All you hear about is the pain. And so with AfroQuiz, I find that it's one way that anybody that's grown up here, their ancestors here, but they're trying to reach out and find out how can I connect with my history and some of the achievements that my people have had. I think attending programs at AfroQuiz, some of us are advocating to have some of that curriculum included in our school program. I think that's going to go a long way in helping most of us have an identity, or at least have a complete identity of what our people have achieved and what we have done, and not just the pain that we often hear about in North America. The Egyptians, we learned about Aksum, we learned about Mansa Musa, we learned about all this history. The Ghana Kingdom was all part of our curriculum. We have to know about these things in order for us to understand our identity, which was really huge because I found that I knew myself a lot more coming here to Canada, which is a place where if you don't know that, your identity sometimes can be misplaced.
It goes back to this whole notion of identity, getting a sense of who you are and where you came from. Once you have that, you're armored against all types of negativity that will come your way. based on your race or your experiences, whatever. But at the end of the day, if you have a good sense of who you are, where you came from, you know that you have a history more than what's been peddled to you by the media and so forth, you're in a much better position. And I work with a lot of kids that unfortunately don't have that. So I see what happens when people aren't tethered by something like a history or a pride in their culture and that sense of self.
Now, of course, learning is fine and all, but it's a quiz show. Do the kids get some prizes? Is there some loot to take home?
We give the kids books because this is about learning. So every contestant, whether or not you're in the top three, you do get a book. On top of that, the top three contestants, they get something. And again, we always want to keep with a theme of learning. So we give them iPads or a laptop or something like that that would encourage their learning to proceed on from that.
If you'd like more information about AfroQuiz, just go to ccach.org or search AfroQuiz. The 2018 competition will be on February 24th. All of the study materials are online. You can register now. Kids from grade 1 all the way to post-secondary can compete. Why not join in the fun yourself? The music in this segment is by Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com. For the Well Endowed Podcast, I'm Minister Faust.
I feel like it was a really successful round, folks. Can we give these 9-year-olds a big round of applause?
A big thanks to Minister Faust for bringing us such a great story. This year, the Afro Quiz will be held on February 24th at the Citadel Theater. You can find more info at ccach.org. That's the website for the Council of Canadians of African and Caribbean Heritage. And we'll post the link on our website. Five Artists, One Love is a two-part event that brings Edmontonians together every February during Black History Month. This year, things kick off with a visual art show and reception at the Art Gallery of Alberta on February 3rd. The exhibit features work from five Black artists from Edmonton, along with a collaborative art wall featuring pieces submitted by artists of all backgrounds. This year's theme for the wall is Take a Knee. Then, on February 10th, things heat up with One Night in Harlem, an evening of music that follows the history of Black culture from the shores of Africa to the hopping club scene in iconic establishments such as the Savoy Ballroom, the Cotton Club, and Apollo Theater. Darren Jordan is the creator and producer of Five Artists, One Love.
Wait, is that the same Darren Jordan we just heard from in Minister Faust's piece?
Indeed he is. And Darren joined me in studio along with musician Nigel Williams to chat about the 12-year history of Five Artists, One Love and the role it plays in Edmonton's art scene. Welcome to the Well Endowed Podcast, Darren and Nigel. How are things going today?
Groovy.
Awesome. Having a good day.
Excellent. So we'll start with you, Darren. Can you tell us a little bit about what Five Artists, One Love is and when it will be going on?
Okay, so I'm gonna go back into time a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about its inception. So I'm from Edmonton originally, born in England, to Caribbean parents. And basically, I had been here most of my life and realized that during Black History Month in particular, I wasn't seeing a lot of representation of Black artists from the city. Didn't even know if there really were any. And I was an artist myself and had the opportunity to do a show. But I thought, well, let's put a shout out, a call for submissions out to people and see if there are other Black artists in the city. And if that's the case, we can highlight and showcase their work. And we did that. It was a really positive experience. The lesson that we're trying to teach, I suppose, is that when you say the words Black community, it's very complex, it's very diverse. There's this cultural mosaic within our community. So I get five artists from different backgrounds. They're all Black and they all live in Edmonton. And their styles are different. Their stories are different.
So who do you have exhibiting this year?
The five artists that we have this year are Shoko Caesar, Trevor Peters, Adana Anakusi, Jay Dante, and Fetsum Telkamariam. The styles are very different and really interesting.
And is this primarily like paintings or are there sculpture? What kind of disciplines can we expect?
So traditionally it's been paint. There have been painters. But in that mix we've also had photographers and sculptors. Shoko Caesar, he's a celebrated design artist, and he bought design to the show for the first time. His element of design was really well received, and so he's back with some new work this year. But yeah, all types.
Excellent. So the second night, which is on February 10th, is a music night. is titled One Night in Harlem, and the programming is designed to explore the history of black music from Africa to the shores of North America, focusing on some of the American clubs at the time that played a very significant role in black history. Can you tell us a little bit about some of those clubs?
Oh, I'd love to. Let me tell you about those clubs. So the first, there are three major clubs that we're looking at. The Cotton Club, the Savoy, and the Apollo. Those three clubs, we're going to follow them from 1922 to current day, because the Apollo, as we know, is still open. And it represents a very important time in American culture and Black American culture as well. I would say Black culture in general. The Cotton Club, it's probably about 1922, 1923, it was actually owned by a white gangster by the name of Oney Madding. And he used it as a means of selling bootleg liquor. But it became an amazing area for music and entertainment. What was interesting about it is that he sort of had set it up like almost like a plantation type feel. And so all the servers and all the performers were black. All the patrons were white. Black people were not allowed to actually sit in the audience, which is fairly interesting. In spite of that, a lot of major careers got started there. The next place that we're talking about, or we're going to be covering in the show, is called the Savoy. The Savoy Ballroom was a little different because it had a white owner. It was managed by a black man. And together, they changed the landscape because they did not have the discrimination clause that other clubs had. So for the first time, you had things like big bands playing against each other. These Battle of the Bands, Chick Webb versus, you know, Benny Goodman or so on and so forth. But they also, it was the birthplace of a dance called the Lindy Hop. And you're now looking at a ballroom that had black kids and white kids dancing together. So that was at a time when America was still segregated. So it's pretty significant. And then the third place is the Apollo. The Apollo is still open. And the Apollo, to many performers, is it's a testing ground. Anybody has played the Apollo. Part of the reason why is because it is a ruthless audience. Back in the day, if you showed up and you were not on point, shoes got thrown at you. Later on, it evolved to, it's just the audience does a dance to get you off the stage, and they boo. And if you do not recover, something horrible happens. They send out a clown with a hook or a broom, or this other gentleman that would tap dance you off stage. And famous people that we know have been booed off stage. I heard Chappelle got booed, James Brown. One of the most famous ones was Lauryn Hill, and God bless her, she stayed the course and she recovered. So it's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to have some elements of that in the show as well.
Excellent. So what kind of genres will we get to hear over the course of the evening?
So the first half is very much a period piece. We've got big band. We're going to do some jazz, some blues. And the second half is going to be more contemporary. We're going to take you from the 1920s all the way to current day. So
Nigel, you're going to be performing on the 10th during the musical night. Can you tell us a little bit about where you fit into the timeline with the genre of music that you play?
Well, for the first half, I'll be probably 1940s, 1950s. So I'll be coming in with that, the first half. And then the second half will be more of what the Apollo is right now.
How did you get into music?
Everything for me stems from church. So I started playing piano when I was six. I started singing in the choir when I was six. And then I never really stopped at all playing or singing in the choir. I still do both of those things to this day. But it allowed me to see just how the different musics combined and intertwined.
I was reading your bio, and there's a little story in there about when you sort of made the choice to take piano lessons. Can you tell us a little bit about that moment?
So being the youngest of three boys, my two brothers are 10 years and 12 years older than me, I was really bugging them. Like, I was really annoying. So it was pretty bad. And they roughed me up a little bit because I was hitting them and slapping them up. You know what little brothers do. And my mom came home and she gave me a choice. She said, will you play the piano or will you play soccer? And my brothers were like, soccer, you got to get into soccer. You can do this. Soccer's you.
And I was like, no, piano. So I picked I picked the piano just because they said soccer. So then I've played ever since.
Well, it seems to be like a choice that's turned out very well for you. What has been sort of your musical trajectory since there?
Well, I've done a lot of different things. I MC a lot of events, and I've definitely sang all over the globe. I moved to Florida just after high school, and I've done a lot of studio work. I've sang in England, Jamaica, Trinidad, and all over the United States and all over Canada. All those places that I've gone to have allowed me to develop as a musician and also as a singer. And then I came back here and started singing with choirs, and then ended up with Five Artists, One Love about 7 years ago, and I haven't turned back since. It's a really good show.
Yeah, so can you tell us a little bit about how important events and organizations like Five Artists, One Love is to artists?
Oh, yeah. The thing about Five Artists, One Love for me is that for me, I started out with one kind of genre of music that I was used to. Five Artists, One Love opens you up to all these different genres, whether it's tribal music or whether it's bass, funk, R&B, rap. All of these things are showcased in Five Artists, One Love. So as an artist, whether you're painting or whether you're singing or you're a musician, you get exposed to a lot of different genres. So it's really a good opportunity, and I'm happy to be a part of Five Artists, One Love.
Well, before we go, I just wanted to ask if there's anything else you might want to chat about that we haven't touched upon.
Certainly. I just want to mention a couple of things. We have a section in the art show called The Wall. We do it every year. And the reason why is because, as I'd mentioned, I pick five black artists. They have to be local, and they have to be, you know, they have to be from Edmonton and have different styles, different backgrounds. And a lot of people have asked, like, how do we get involved? I'd love to get involved, you know, but they're not necessarily black. And so I have a section that is, it's more inclusive. Basically, it's called The Wall. It's the one part of the show where you're tethered to a theme. But if you want to be part of the show, and anybody can, you would submit a 12 by 12, 2-inch width canvas based on whatever the theme is. So the theme in past has been civil rights movement, Black Lives Matter, question mark, There Goes the Neighborhood, Got Soul, things like that. And this year it's hashtag take a knee. So we're, you know, some commentary on Kaepernick's, his quiet protest. And what that means, we're not taking a political stance either way. I want to hear what other people have to say. And this year, for the first time, we're taking on a charity in support of Autism Edmonton, which is an organization that's kind of close to my heart. We're doing our part to raise awareness about the autistic spectrum disorder and the work that the Autism Edmonton does here in our city.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks to Darren Jordan and Nigel Williams for speaking with us. The art reception is on February 3rd at the Art Gallery of Alberta. The artist's work will also be exhibited in the University of Augustana Campus Library and at the Scott Gallery until February 25th.
And One Night in Harlem takes place February 10th in Allard Hall at McEwen University. You can get your tickets at ticksonthesquare.ca, and we'll have the link on our website. Okay, Elizabeth, I heard you had quite the gathering in our studio here the other day.
You're right. We had almost the whole gang from the Edmonton Shift Lab cozied up in here. The Edmonton Shift Lab is exploring ways to work with communities to end racism. When the Shift Lab was launched last fall, Ashley Dryberg joined us on the very first episode to talk about how racism and poverty intersect and how people experience racism individually and systematically.
Right. The Shift Lab is a social innovation lab. These labs seek to build prototypes for things like programming, policy innovation, and services. They put these prototypes into action and learn how it works or doesn't work within the community.
To do this, the Shift Lab follows a five-step process. First, they start with empathy as they collect stories, conduct research, and listen to what is found. Using those findings, they develop questions that identify areas of need. They brainstorm ways to meet those needs with community members. They work with collaborators from various fields to build prototypes. Then those prototypes are put into action to see how they actually function in the community.
It's an exciting process, and the key to success lays in the diversity of perspective that the lab seeks to include.
Currently, the lab has five stewards: Ashley Dryberg, Ben Weinlich, Jody Stonehouse, Samir Singh, and Aaliyah Valji. Unfortunately, Aaliyah was not able to join us, but I was able to sit down with Ashley, Ben, Jody, and Samir. Well, thank you guys for being here today. We're here basically with the Shift Lab group.
So I'm Ben Weinlich, and I run a social enterprise through Skills Society called the Action Lab. Tantse Kapa Pamas Kamganaka Squayo Natsigasun, Otsinia Michelle First Nation. Hello, I'm Jody Kalahu Stonehouse. I'm from the Michelle First Nation. We are Cree and Mohawk peoples.
Hi, I am Ashley Dryberg. I work with the Edmonton Community Foundation.
Namaste. I'm Samir Singh, one of the stewards of the Shift Lab.
Can you give us a little bit of an idea of what Shift Lab is?
So the Shift Lab is a social innovation lab that is designed to bring people from different backgrounds and experiences together to tackle a problem relating to social issues.
So really what they look like is we bring in diverse people into the lab and we get people to use different tools, systems thinking tools, design tools, indigenous ways of sense making around challenges to be able to understand what are the root causes of this challenge, like a challenge like racism, and how are we going to work towards finding solutions with community. And we say, let's not just talk about an idea, let's make it tangible. Let's see what that would look like and feel like. Because when we make things tangible, we can see our assumptions and biases better, and we can see, oh, that didn't work the way I envisioned it in my mind. We got to change this and tweak it.
Last year, you had quite a few things in the fire. Can you talk a little bit about the highlights from last year?
Wow. The last year for me has been absolutely unbelievable. The first highlight, I suppose, that emerges for me are the three prototypes that ended up coming out of the work that we did. I can tell you a little bit about them if you like. The first one is called Journey to Yimby, and it's trying to create a best practices guide for not-for-profits in Edmonton who want to build affordable housing projects. And one key component of this work is to use the city's open data to start dispelling some of the myths that surround affordable housing. The second one is called the Landlord Diversity Certification Program, and this would be working with large landlords, corporate landlords, to offer them some training in diversity about how to welcome new and diverse clients into their rental environment. The third one is called a mobile legal aid van, and the key here is how do we bring a wraparound service to racialized tenants in particular who might be experiencing conflict with their landlords or may not understand fully their rights. And so either a van would travel around in a particular circuit or it might be called out to a particular apartment building. And in that van, there would be perhaps someone from legal aid, perhaps someone from the Landlord Tenancy Advisory Board, perhaps a translator to offer these services in a one-stop shop. All of these prototypes are in various places of implementation. They're still very, very new. They're still being tested, but we hope over the next year we're going to see some results with them.
As we've heard, the Edmonton Shift Lab is working with diverse perspectives to create prototypes for community initiatives. I wanted to know what was next for Shift Lab. Turns out the stewards have been grappling with that very question.
I think before we can jump ahead to what's next, we had to really reflect on what we uncovered in this project itself. We also had to look at, okay, how does social innovation align with Indigenous practices and processes? Part of the work that I did along with Shift Lab was, A, learn about social innovation, learning the language, the process, and then how does that reflect and align with Indigenous processes and legal traditions? So what are the ways that Indigenous people can use social innovation to reclaim, restore, and repair the damage that has been done to our own legal traditions, to our own processes? So that also became a piece of the work that we did with the Edmonton Shift Lab. So not only were we looking at our own three prototypes, we are also looking at a much bigger scale of how to do the work of reconciliation through social innovation practices.
Jody spoke about how bringing in ideas around reconciliation also inspired big questions about the impact of cultural worldviews.
So we're currently in the thinking through stage, and so part of it is looking at the epistemology. So social innovation is embedded in a particular worldview. That's historically been the issue, is that the Western worldview, the Western epistemology, pedagogies have been what are the doctrines and what determine the ways in which we make decisions to govern. And so it's a lot of work behind the scenes that the Shift Lab is doing, asking questions. And I would say that the next phase is about, okay, how do we take these questions and move with community in a way that we can start to do some of this work?
Sorting out the best way to bring a diverse group of people into a discussion around racism can seem a bit abstract, but it's exactly the kind of thinking that is needed to develop best practices. Ben and Sam shared some examples of how the team's brainstorming has been used in the lab.
There's a thing in human-centered design, which is a lab process, where people go out to interview and capture stories that have happened to understand a problem. It's a like death by sticky note, pretty much. A lot of too many sticky notes. And Jody had mentioned, well, you know, there are some, I think you were calling them mnemonic devices that in Indigenous traditions of using your hands for storytelling and beading and things like this to explore around story listening and storytelling. So really trying to figure out, how do we learn from each other? And I think that's, to me, the spirit of reconciliation. There's some awesome stuff here in these traditions, in these ways, and in these design approaches. Can we make them work together and also understand where they don't work together and make progress?
And I think that kind of gets to the heart of what social innovation or design thinking can do for exploring a topic that's so nebulous as racism. So things that might even seem somewhat simplistic, like drawing, for example, or using your hands for beading, or telling stories with pictures and cards, role-playing, these are all different techniques that are ways that people express themselves and also provide avenues for insights for us to better explore this question. Because one of the insights we realized early on is that knowledge comes in many, many forms. And quite often, traditionally, there's only been a few areas that it's been respected and valued. So, for example, as an icebreaker, one of the things we did is we asked everyone to tell us a story about their family and their parents and where they came from and how did they meet and how did that end up with these people being here in Edmonton.
As Sam was talking about, that's rooted in sort of a Coast Salish house tradition. When you come to someone's feast hall, you have to state who it is that you are, your family that you represent. It's essentially being able to recognize the role and responsibility that you carry with your family name. And so bringing that tradition into the Shift Lab enabled us to open up a vulnerability, I guess, with one another.
Sam also talked about how the lab looks to what others are doing to help find new ways of opening a community dialogue around racism.
Well, one thing that we're doing is looking at best practices and examples of where there has been a shift when it comes to people with, for example, racist attitudes. There's a fellow in the United States, for example, he's a black man, and he's gone around to meet members of the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, and he engages with them and talks to them and asks them, you know, why do you believe the things that you do when it comes to race? And he actually befriends them, and as a sign of almost conversion is that they give him their KKK robes when they basically dropped that belief system. And to date, he has about 60 robes from Ku Klux Klan members. So understanding how he's able to affect this change amongst people who in other situations would never give him the time of day is something interesting to examine.
I think one of the tricky things with that is a lot of people with this kind of work are expecting that minds shift, you know, that all of a sudden there is like knowledge generated and a magical understanding happens and then people's behavior change. And that's pretty tough. That's really big long-term work around that. So we're all aware of that and careful of what can be possible there.
And in fact, one of the things that makes me really excited about the Shift Lab, other than all of the work that we're doing, is I think that we have a window right now where people are willing to talk about racism. And this window is not going to be open forever. And so my hope is that when this window closes and the inevitable backlash happens, the next time that this window opens, we're just a little bit further along in the conversation, and that what we learn and what we uncover in this process, we are able to communicate out so that other people who are working on racism in the future don't have to start from square one again.
You have the three prototypes that you've developed through the Social Innovation Lab process. Will you continue to develop new prototypes, or will you take these ones and just keep tweaking them?
Both. We are going to continue to support the three prototypes that have been developed, and we hope over the course of Shift Lab 2.0, we're going to develop another new suite of prototypes so that by the end of Shift Lab 2.0, we're going to be having prototypes doing lots of different things in lots of different stages.
Many thanks to Ashley Dryberg, Ben Weinlich, Jody Stonehouse, and Samir Singh for sharing their time with us. The Edmonton Shift Lab is embarking on its second year. If you'd like to keep up with them, be sure to visit edmontonshiftlab.ca, where you can sign up for their newsletter and find out about opportunities to join in with the community gatherings.
The team will be releasing an evaluation report of the lab's first phase, so you'll be able to find that on their website in the coming weeks. Edmonton Community Foundation has the privilege of working with some very generous donors who create funds that help support a wide variety of charities throughout Edmonton. We'd like to introduce you to Neil Gower.
Hi, I'm Neil Gower. I recently retired after more than 40 years of practicing law, and I was asked why I'm involved with the Edmonton Community Foundation. I have been involved as secretary to the board, but I've also set up a donor-advised fund with the very creative name of the Gower Family Fund. Community involvement's always been very important to my family. We've been longtime Edmontonians. Two sets of my great-grandparents came here in the 1890s. So the development of Edmonton and the protection of its people has always been important. The Edmonton Community Foundation appeals to me for three reasons. Trust. I really like to know that the fund is well managed, professionally managed, and that there's a very well qualified investment committee of volunteers to oversee it. Flexibility. We can react quickly and every year differently to different needs as they arise in the community. And then finally, their knowledge of the community and the community's needs is unsurpassed, in my opinion. Oh, it feels good to give the money out. I get a note about how much money is available for distribution, and I can either designate who I want to get money that year, depending on particular needs, whether it's homelessness or whatever. Or in some cases, I say to the people at the Community Foundation, you pick. You know, are there things we should be doing this year? And I trust them completely to have the good of the city in mind.
Thanks so much, Neil, for telling us about your fund and what it means to you. For any of our listeners out there who are curious about how to create a fund, our donor services team is always happy to help answer your questions. You can visit us at ecfoundation.org for more ways to get in touch.
Okay, time for this month's shout out. So I went to the Oilers game in Las Vegas a couple weeks ago, and we went down for my brother-in-law's 30th birthday. And it also happened to be Connor McDavid's birthday that night as well. I have to say that it was pretty impressive listening to the thousands of Oilers fans sing happy birthday to McDavid. Though, for the record, I want to make it clear that yes, I was singing happy birthday at the same time as everybody else, but I was singing it to Eli, not Connor. I just wanted to make that clear. Anyway, before we caught our flight home, I was looking for some podcasts to listen to on the plane, and I downloaded a few episodes of Hockey Feels. And that's who I'd like to give a shout-out to this month. Hockey Feels is hosted by Stephen Schepansky and Rachel Donner. Stephen is an Oilers fan, and Rachel is crazy for the Philadelphia Flyers. And what I like about their podcast is that it doesn't get bogged down in stats or just focus on hockey news. It gets into how hockey makes them feel. It's a ton of fun, so if you're a hockey fan, subscribe to Hockey Feels on iTunes and see how it makes you feel. I bet you it'll be good. You can also find it on the CKUA radio app, where you can subscribe to all of the amazing shows on the Alberta Podcast Network. And we'll have the link on our website. We are nearing the end of our show, which means
news time.
So there's just two granting deadlines to share. So listen to see if you or someone you know might be eligible for funding. First up is the deadline for our Young Edmonton Grants Program, and that's on February 15th. These grants range from $500 to $3,000 and are for projects that are initiated, led, and organized by Edmontonians between the ages of 13 and 24.
And the deadline for community grants is on March 1st. These are grants for charities in the greater Edmonton area and can be for up to $40,000. If your organization is in need of funding, please visit the ECF website to learn more. And that brings us to the end of the February edition of the Well Endowed podcast. Thanks to each of our guests for sharing their stories with us.
And thanks to all of you, our listeners, for spending your time with us. We hope you enjoyed the show.
And if you did, please be sure to share this episode with your friends and subscribe to us on iTunes and Google Play. We've been your hosts, Elizabeth Bonking
and Andrew Paul. Until next time.
The Well Endowed podcast is produced by Edmonton Community Foundation
and is an affiliate member of the Alberta Podcast Network.
The show is edited by Lisa Pruden.
You can visit our website at thewellendowedpodcast.com.
Subscribe to us on iTunes.
And follow us on Twitter at the ECF.
Our theme music is by Octavo Productions.
And as always, don't forget to visit Edmonton Community Foundation at ecfoundation.org.
Endowed. Did you know that when the Rogers Arena was just opened, that Glenn Sathers had a golf cart inside the Rogers place and brought the bundle carrier from Muscogee, and the building was smudged and the Oilers were prayed for in an Indigenous way to start the season?
They should try praying for them right now because they're not doing so well.